This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Vince Warren about the Center for Constitutional Rights campaign titled The First 100 Days. 20 years later, dozens of black men who were tortured remain behind bars after giving false confessions to Chicago police.
This scandal goes all the way up to the mayor of Chicago. We'll talk with Flynn Taylor from People's Law Office, who will again bring us up to date on the outrage of torture in Chicago.
We'll also hear from lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who spoke at the event Beyond Guantanamo. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today we talk with Vincent Warren, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, about the CCR campaign titled The First 100 Days. The First 100 Days is a blueprint for actions for the next president's administration. Warren says there is a clear opportunity for the next president to steer a whole new course, to repudiate the executive orders that have been put in place by George W. Bush and by the sidestepping of the Justice Department. A lot of the reversal can be done without Congress, because they involve presidential executive orders. The First 100 Days campaign will put this information in the hands of the people to make the next administration accountable for undoing the actions of the last 8 years. Vince, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Heidi.
Vince, I understand the Center for Constitutional Rights has been thinking about planning, etc., what should happen in the first 100 days of a new presidency, no matter who the new president is. Can you just give us some outline of what your thinking is and what kinds of issues you're interested in taking on or having a president really take on in the first 100 days?
Sure. You know, as you know, the Center for Constitutional Rights has really been at the forefront of almost all of the legal issues that have presented themselves since George Bush has been in office and since 9/11, and we've been fighting those battles day in and day out on the legal front. One of the things that is happening now is that there is a clear opportunity for the next president to turn the whole ship around, to repudiate all of the executive orders that have been put in place by George Bush, all of the sidestepping by the Justice Department, the weakness in Congress. And there's an opportunity now for us to call on the next president to be able to do some things that this current and existing president and his cronies really didn't want to do. You know, one of the founders of the center and my mentor and constitutional law professor in law school, Arthur Kanoy, would say that, you know, it's not really fair to just talk about three branches of government. It's that there's a fourth branch of government, and that fourth branch is the people. And the policy prescriptions and the work that we're going to be doing over the next several months is really going to be geared towards helping the public, the people, work to push the next president to address some of these concerns in the first 100 days of his presidency. And it really doesn't matter who it is, because it's going to take a tremendous amount of pushing and advocacy on all of our parts to be able to move this stuff through.
Why don't you start with what's the first thing you would want to see done?
The first thing that absolutely positively has to happen is closing down Guantanamo, but not just closing down the facility and shipping the men off to other secret black holes around the world. The Supreme Court decision in Boumediene spoke very clearly that the Constitution applies to those men, and specifically that habeas corpus applies to them, and the government has two choices, either to try them or release them, and it is clear that they're not going to charge or try most of the men there. It's up to the government to immediately have these habeas corpus hearings, which we're working on, and then to release the men safely to the countries that they came from, if they can go back there safely, to third countries if they are UN-mandated refugees or have other refugee concerns. But to empty that facility, to close it down, and then to stop the basis for why that facility was created to begin with, which is it was an enormous legal black hole that was a tank for a foray into interrogation and exploration into where all the terrorists are in the world. And the U.S. government just simply can't do that. It's against international law, and it's against the Constitution and domestic laws.
I understand that a lot of this can be done without going to Congress, can be done just by the president, because some of this comes out of executive orders. Is that right?
As you know, Michael, Military Order Number 1, which was issued, an executive order that was issued by George Bush shortly after September 11th, was, according to the government, the basic underpinning that George Bush could use those powers to detain anybody that he wanted any place in the world for any reason for any period of time. A simple revisiting of the executive orders that George Bush put in and striking those and issuing either new executive orders where necessary or rescinding those orders would be an enormous step in putting the powers of the presidency back in the constitutional box that the president can order as a chief of the military. He can order the military to take immediate action to close down that facility, and he has control over the policies of his agencies in terms of how they conduct interrogations and what their detention policy is going to be. So it really does, just as it was started by an illegal expansion of power by President Bush, it can be ended by executive order to a large degree with the next president.
You were continuing, Vince, as to what other kinds of things you wanted in the first 100 days?
Yes, you know, there are a lot of problems. And, you know, one of the things that we're doing at the center is we're really beginning to look to frame the George Bush legacy, specifically with respect to the war on terror. But there are a number of issues that bear immediate action within the first 100 days. And amongst those, there is the warrantless wiretapping, that is, allowing the National Security Agency and other government agencies to not go before courts to get warrants to wiretap people in the United States or people in the United States that are communicating with people abroad. There has been a long-standing requirement, constitutional requirement, that you can't wiretap without any kind of judicial oversight, and this is what the George Bush administration has been doing. There is a congressional fix to this, which Congress has not really wanted to take in any meaningful way, but there's also something that the president can do. The president can order the National Security Agency, has complete control over those agencies, to take warrants for wiretaps to judges and let the judges determine the sufficiency of the evidence, and then have a judge make a determination as to whether the wiretap is legal or not. There's the broad issue of torture and rendition, which are in some ways two different things and in some contexts the same. The torture problem that has been exposed during this administration is really, I think, unprecedented in scope domestically in the United States. That is not to say that the U.S. has not been actively involved in torturing people around the world for a long period of time. But this is the scenario in which they've really gotten caught. Not only gotten caught doing it, but they've gotten caught in a lie. And the policies with respect to torture by U.S. personnel can immediately be changed by the president in terms of getting the various branches of the executive to comply with the military interrogation policies to not have the CIA or the FBI or the DOD run amok and develop their own interrogation policies, which essentially amount to torture. Another piece of the torture, which we're going to be calling on the president to do, is that there has to be some sort of accountability for this. You know, when I was a public defender in Brooklyn, when I asked a kid, well, why did you punch the guy back 3 weeks after you got into a fight with him? And he said, well, you can't stay hit. And that's what's true here in America. We have been hit. Men in Guantanamo have been hit. And you can't stay hit. There have to be consequences, or else this is not a democracy. And so we're going to be calling on the president to take some leadership to really begin the process of investigation and the exploration of criminal charges against the people who are responsible for this. And we're not just talking about the low-hanging fruit. We're talking about high-level officials. There are a range of issues that sort of overlay the Bush program post 9/11, and the key issue is secrecy. As you know, Heidi, Michael, and Michael, that when you do these cases in federal courts, the government hides behind two basic issues, and one is national security issue, and the other one is that they don't want to expose what they're doing, even to a judge, because they fear that the techniques that they use will get out there in the world. Now, of course, the problem is that the techniques that they're using are illegal. So the whole idea of trying to shield from the courts and, by extension, from the lawyers and the clients that have been the subject of these terrible things, to try to shield them from the truth is really not protecting national security at all, but what it is doing is protecting government officials from their rampantly illegal behavior. So we're going to be focusing on government secrecy and specifically looking for the next president to repudiate the policy of invoking the state's secret doctrine in cases the way that this administration has done. It's done it more than any other administration in the past. And, you know, just to get a little bit technical in the legal piece, it really was not designed to get cases dismissed. It was designed to allow the government to say that there are national security concerns with respect to some of the things that we're doing. But the government has been taking the position that all they have to do is raise the national security flag and the state secrets flags and the cases get kicked out of court. And that's been happening time and time again. And from the center's point of view, you know, we take cases for a whole range of reasons, but the most important reasons, aside from getting justice for the people that have been abused by the government, is to get the truth out there. We need to know what the government is doing and how it's doing it so that we can take steps to stop it.
Can you tell us how your approach will differ in terms of putting pressure on the new president, depending on which party comes into office? Will there be litigation, possibly?
Our approach at the Center for Constitutional Rights will likely not differ in a meaningful respect, no matter who the next president is. What really matters is what steps is he going to take immediately to reverse the illegal behavior that was put into play by this president. And I think if we live in a paradigm in the next presidency where the torture and interrogation policies are still in practice, where warrantless wiretapping is still happening, if men are being detained illegally without any access to the courts, men and women, the next president has to expect that we will file lawsuits to move those cases forward if we have to.
One of your plans here, Vince, isn't it, is to make this into a big campaign, not just litigation, but to really say to the public that in the first 100 days, this can happen, a president can do a lot of this alone, and we insist on it?
The goal here on this particular campaign is to tie in with the litigation strategy, and that this is going to, we're going to issue a series of white papers that will be available on our website, that will be distributed through the web media and other media, to be able to put in the hands of everyday people sort of the analysis of what the problem is, an analysis of what the next president can do, and then people can use these documents as tools to provide pressure for the next president, for the Congress, for whoever they see fit, to make sure that these broad agenda changes that are necessary happen very quickly within the first 100 days, really is going to be relying on people around the country to be able to take in the information and to be able to take action along with us to make sure that the next president does the right thing.
Vince, one of the things they've done is, in a sense, turn democracy on its head by all this police spying, where they can know everything about you and you can't know anything about them. Does the center have any intentions of taking on stuff like you can't use the FOIA Act anymore, Freedom of Information Act, or the Patriot Act, where they get your governmental records, your medical records, everything like that? Is the center addressing, you know, that kind of the government can learn everything about you, but the government itself remains secret?
Well, we've dealt with that in a lot of ways over the years. Center for Constitutional Rights has come out with, you know, a series of papers and analyses of the Patriot Act, challenged the Patriot Act in various contexts, and we've moved forward with just about every legislative measure that the government has put forward, especially as it affects the litigation that we're doing. But with respect to the Freedom of Information Act, we litigate Freedom of Information Act. I think we probably have 6 or 7 cases that are happening right now. And our real focus is on transparency. And we're going to be pressuring the government to allow the Freedom of Information Act requests get filed, to not have onerous amounts of money that it costs to do these type of things, and to really pressure the government to make this information available to the attorneys, to the clients and to the general public.
Of course, one thing, Vince, I recall on the FOIA stuff is when Bush took office and after 9/11, Ashcroft issued a new, essentially administrative interpretation of FOIA. The old rule was that you should give the documents, make them public, unless there was a serious chance that they would impinge on national security. And I think Ashcroft changed the balance. He said, don't give any documents if there's any chance or something like that. In any case, he changed the balance. When you and I have talked, I think that's one thing also. We just want to get that so-called executive Ashcroft order changed.
That's exactly right. And within the Patriot Act, it's clear that the Attorney General has more power than any other Attorney General prior to that act. And that in terms of the power that the Attorney General now has, of a whole range of things that he's done and subsequent attorneys general have done, to make it more difficult to find out the truth. It's essentially having the Attorney General covering up for the government rather than moving forth and adhering to the law the way that the Attorney General is supposed to be.
Vince, give us your website so we can link to it so our listeners can get into what the center's doing.
CCRjustice.org, www.ccrjustice.org. And when you go to the website, you can find out the latest information. You'll be able to find information on this 100 Days campaign. You'll be able to find out the white papers that we will be issuing between September and January on a whole range of these things. And you'll find, if you sign up for our action alerts, you'll be able to find out things that you can do as a member of the public to help make this next administration accountable for turning the ship around and restoring the Constitution.
Vince, so we can check the website and things will be gearing up in September on this campaign?
We'll be issuing our first warrantless wiretapping document around the end of August. And then in September, we are slated to have a white paper on torture, detention, and rendition. And then moving through December, there'll be other white papers that are available. So you will be able to, if you sign up for the web alerts, you'll be able to have access to those white papers the moment that they come out.
Vince, it's been a pleasure to have you on. And I can say that your former professor and mentor to all of us here, Arthur Kanoi, would be very proud of the work that you and the center are doing. Thank you so much.
Bye bye.
Thanks, guys.
According to the People's Law Office in Chicago, at least 24 African American men are still serving sentences for crimes they say they confessed to after being tortured by Chicago police officers. This happened when the Chicago South Side precinct was under Commander John Burge between 1972 and 1992. Here on Law and Disorder, on our June 7, 2007 program, we discussed how some of the victims were pardoned or given new trials, but the vast majority of the 100-plus cases have yet to be reviewed by the state of Illinois. Those men have either served out their sentences, died in custody, or continue to live their lives behind bars. Today we talk with Flint Taylor, attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, who is leading the fight against covering up torture by the Chicago Police Department. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Flint, once again.
I'm very happy to be with you again.
Well, we're interested in an update in the case of the men who were tortured in Chicago.
It's interesting because things still, the struggle's still going on 35 years after the torture started. Although there have been significant victories by this movement and people, the human rights and anti-death penalty movements in dealing with the torture and the remedies that arise out of the systemic torture, there's still much to be done, and we're still fighting those issues and trying to raise those issues in various forums. There's the city claimed the big, I wouldn't call it a victory, but they claimed that they'd ended a nightmare when they settled for torture cases last year, and it was very significant. They settled four cases for $19.8 million after trying to back out of that settlement for over a year. But there are still things going on with the city. There is a fifth torture case, Daryl Cannon, who I represent, who the city has admitted was tortured, but who they settled with over 20 years ago for $3,000 before any of the evidence of torture came out, of the systemic torture. So under Seventh Circuit law, if there's a conspiracy to cover up the evidence in a civil case sufficient to show fraud, then you can bring the case again. So we brought the case in 2005, and the city refuses to settle the case, and they're pumping hundreds of thousands of dollars into Burge's defense in that case. So it makes the lie of the idea that they ended the nightmare. They're still over the $10 million mark and pumping money to the defense of Burge. We've calculated that the pensions that have been paid over the last 10 or 15 years to Burge and the other some 25 implicated torturers, and it's over $10.8 million, and it's over $1.3 million a year is being paid in pensions. So the cry for reparations and treatment we have been raising, and that's that the men who, because of the statute of limitations, have no legal remedy, unlike the torturers who have not only pensions but health benefits, these men have no treatment, and many of them are now on the street after spending many years in the penitentiary. So that's an issue. That's one issue has to do with the city of Chicago.
You mentioned Burge, and I'm not sure that our listeners remember who this guy is and what he did. So I'd like to elaborate more on what's happened to a lot of these people who haven't had any compensation. But first, talk about Burge, will you?
Oh, certainly. Burge came back from Vietnam in 1970, joined the Chicago Police Department, and shot through the ranks all the way to commander. And he did that primarily by leading a band of torturers. He brought back the torture techniques from Vietnam, electric shock, dry submarino, that is suffocating people with bags, using mock executions, and other kinds of straight-up torture techniques on African-American suspects in the station houses in Chicago for the next 20 years with a merry band of some 15 to 25 white detectives under his command, and getting confessions, sending people to the penitentiary, sending people to death row. And it went on for 20 years until through some cases that we did and a lot of public scrutiny that came as a result of the evidence that we uncovered, it was established that there was a ring of torture. He was fired, but nothing else was done. And men remained on death row for many years until the governor of the state of Illinois, George Ryan, not only cleared death row in the sense of granting commuting sentences to life from death back in 2003, but he granted pardons on the basis of innocence to four of the torture victims. That reopened those cases civilly as well. And there's been a battle around police torture ever since the 80s when this started to become known, and it's been a battle in the civil courts. It's been a battle to attempt to get Burge indicted along with the men under his command. It's been a battle to get the men off of death row and out of the prisons and to get them new hearings. And it's been a battle to expose the fact that the state's attorney or the DA in Cook County at that time, Richard Daley, who's now, of course, the powerful mayor, and his first assistant, Richard Devine, who has been subsequently the DA or state's attorney in Cook County for the last 10 years, to have them brought on the carpet because they could have prosecuted Burge, had evidence to prosecute Burge criminally back in the 80s, and rather than to do that, permitted this torture ring to continue. Kind of the short version of who John Burge and what the torture scandal in Chicago is.
It's quite amazing because I know you, through lots of public education, hard work, and testifying, you've gotten much of the city council behind you. You've gotten a lot of press on this. And nonetheless, there are some 20 people that remain in prison, other people whose lives have been shattered. And it seems to me that the right thing hasn't been done yet. So what are you guys going to do next?
We're fighting on all these fronts. As I mentioned, the civil cases, we're attempting to get city council back oriented on the fact of all the strong talk they made of in terms of not defending Burge anymore and that kind of thing, and of settling all of the cases and getting reparations for the men who have no other remedies. But there are also, as you mentioned, men still in the penitentiary on the basis of confessions that were tortured from them. There's a struggle going on right now to get the Attorney General, who has quite a liberal image, Lisa Madigan, to deal with these cases. The reason that she's dealing with these cases rather than the state's attorney, Richard Devine, who I mentioned earlier, is because there was a conflict found by the chief judge of the criminal courts, because Devine not only worked for Daley when the torture was not prosecuted, but he subsequently went into private practice, and his law firm represented Burge for many years in the civil cases that we were litigating. So a judge finally found that his inaction and failure to do anything with, as a state's attorney with regard to torture, was arose from a conflict because he was Burge's lawyer. So he was disqualified, and the Attorney General of the state of Illinois was put in his place. But she has been very, very reluctant to do anything, and no justice has been done. No new hearings have been given, like you would see, you saw in L.A. with the Rampart scandal, and in Philadelphia when it was police corruption and brutality was exposed in a raft of criminal cases. Here, the torture cases and the men who are still in the penitentiary on the basis of tortured confessions haven't been given new hearings to air out their torture claims and to throw their confessions out of court and give them a new trial without the tortured confessions if the courts find that right. And that's a major demand that's being raised now. A third one, which is central to this, is the idea that Burge, we liken him to the Klan or the Nazis in the South, who orchestrated the killings of the civil rights workers and the blowing up of the Birmingham church, that no matter how long it takes, we want to see them behind bars. And we have recently had some success in getting the U.S. Attorney, Patrick Fitzgerald, who Penny in New York will remember, to do a serious investigation into obstruction of justice, perjury, and conspiracy by all of these men, Burge and all the others, in these civil cases that we are litigating. They have come in and remarkably, under oath, denied. I say remarkably because you think they would have had criminal lawyers that told them to take the fifth, but at times they have testified and denied all forms of torture. Of course, if you can prove that that's a lie, you have obstruction of justice, you have a conspiracy, and you have perjury. And that is what the FBI and the U.S. Attorney is investigating right now. And we're hopeful that by November, when the statute on limitations on some of these crimes run, that we're going to have federal indictments against Burge and many of the others. So that's another major front that we're fighting right now. We're guardedly optimistic that we may well see some of these torturers behind bars, like Al Capone and others of Chicago fame, or in fame, based on these allegations and investigation by the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Flint, we're looking forward to the day we have you back on the show to talk about your success on this. Have you thought about the connection between this guy who's torturing people in Vietnam, comes back to Chicago, and he's torturing people on the south side of Chicago, black people, and
right,
the connection between that and the federal government, the CIA, torturing people in Guantanamo and the black sites around the world?
Oh, definitely, and when we write and speak about it, we that's what we talk about, and those links. And I think one part that I wanted to mention, another part that we have been steadfastly fighting on, is the international level. And we started in 2005 going to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington, and we had a hearing there. Then we went to the Committee Against Torture of the United Nations, and we presented the evidence of Burge and torture to them back in 2006, and they issued official recommendations on the U.S., and in it, they connected three of the across-the-board torture situations of the U.S. government. And one, of course, is Abu Ghraib, and one is Guantanamo, and the third was Burge and Chicago torture. And they specifically chastised the U.S. government proceeding with prosecutions against Burge in Chicago. So that was a major victory that we were able to accomplish. And just recently, the UN Rapporteur on Racism came to Chicago and conducted a two-day hearing at which the torture cases were prominently featured, and some of our clients who are victims of torture and some of our lawyers testified to the UN's Rapporteur. And again, we're hopeful that in the report on U.S. racism, that torture in Chicago and the failure to prosecute and the cover-up of torture by major officials of the city will be featured. The final struggle that I'll mention with regard to the international front is, as you all may know, Chicago and its mayor are obsessed with the Olympics coming to Chicago in 2016. There are many reasons that, mostly racial reasons and economic reasons, why it's not a good idea. But now, first and foremost, the Black People Against Police Torture in Chicago, and we have been raising the issue of it's the torture capital of the world, and of at least of the United States, and that till the city and the county deals with this torture situation satisfactorily, there should be no mention or that there should be no Olympics in Chicago. And John Carlos came out and he supported that. John Carlos, of course, and of Carlos and Tommy Smith fame in the 68 Olympics is strongly behind this. And so we've been raising quite a bit of issue on what Daley's pet project is, and that is the 2016 Olympics. So internationally, and the links between all of these outrageous forms of torture that the U.S. has continued to be involved in are very paramount in our approach to the torture question.
Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office, you're following in Malcolm X's footsteps on this. He wanted to take these issues of racism and human rights denials to the United Nations. You're internationalizing them. You're causing a lot of trouble, and we're proud to have you on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm always very happy to be with you all. I know that you all are deeply involved in important work as well, and kind of we stand together on all of this.
Thank you, Flint. You take it easy.
Okay.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Go now to hear excerpts of speeches from attorneys at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who spoke at the event titled Beyond Guantanamo. Now that key rulings issued by the Supreme Court affirm the constitutional rights of Guantanamo detainees to challenge their detention in the federal courts, what does the future hold for these prisoners and the rule of law? In the cases of Boumediene v. Bush and Al-Oda v. United States, the June 2008 Supreme Court ruling has undone the attempts of the Bush administration and Congress to suspend the fundamental right of habeas corpus. Closing Guantanamo is the number one on the list of actions in the first 100 days for the next president's administration. Among the speakers are Vincent Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Stephen Abraham, Guantanamo whistleblower, attorney, and U.S. Army Reserve officer who served on a military combatant status review tribunal. Baher Azmi, professor of law, Seton Hall University, and habeas counsel to Guantanamo detainees. We go now to hear Pardis Cabral, staff attorney, Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Let's have a listen.
Thank you. As Annette was saying, I joined the Guantanamo work relatively recently, and it's really a privilege, and I'm quite humbled to be up on the stage with people like Stephen Abraham and Bahar, who played such pivotal roles in this work from the beginning, and also with Annette and Vince, who with CCR took on these cases when no one would. So just to give props that way to all of you on the stage. I wanted to talk about a few specific prisoners who I have met in the past year at Guantanamo and in Afghanistan, whose situations present different scenarios of what Boumediene might mean for different detainees at Guantanamo, including the potential reach of the decision, as well as maybe some of the limitations in certain cases for certain individuals. I'll start with one of CCR's clients, who is a Yemeni individual by the name of Mohammed Taher, for whom Boumediene will hopefully soon mean a court decision finding that his detention is in fact unlawful, and ordering him released from Guantanamo and returned home to Yemen. Mr. Taher has spent most of his 20s in Guantanamo. He was transferred there in 2002 along with his older brother, who is one of five detainees who have actually died in U.S. custody at Guantanamo, and whose death the government and the military have yet to fully explain. They say they've been investigating for 2 years, and yet their families and the public still don't exactly know what happened. The government has justified detaining Mr. Taher for over 6 years on the basis of an allegation of association with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, but the strongest evidence that it's purported to say that it has against him is an accusation that a senior member of Al-Qaeda identified him under torture in a photograph and said, you know, I know this guy. And a postcard that he was apparently sent by a Taliban official. I mean, these are the two major bases of evidence that we've seen from the government against this individual and that have stood as the basis for his detention for over 6 years. Mr. Taher, neither we nor Mr. Taher have been able to see the postcard or question the Al-Qaeda individual who made the identification, and that's where we are. From the evidence that we've seen, it's clear that Mr. Taher is not at Guantanamo because he is one of the 60 to 80 individuals that the government says it plans to charge. And as Bahar was saying, no more than 20 at this point have been charged at all with any kind of crime. He's also not there because he can't return to his home country, which is the situation that about 50 or so men are in, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Despite the weakness of the government's allegations against him, he remains at Guantanamo in large part because he happens to be from a country that has not had the political leverage and in part the political will to effectively negotiate with the United States for his return home. As more politically powerful countries have been able to do and as closer allies of the United States have been able to do. Without habeas, before Boumediene, and the ability of the courts to decide whether a prisoner should continue to be detained or should be released by weighing the evidence and looking at the facts, the government has controlled decisions about who stays and who gets to leave Guantanamo and under what terms. And while those decisions have been affected by a confluence of different factors, political factors and political dynamics have figured quite dominantly in the calculus and have impacted how effective a country has been able to be at the negotiating table with the United States and the final terms that have been negotiated for the release of its citizens. So just to take one example, which is sort of a striking example, a comparison, at one time Saudi Arabia and Yemen had comparable numbers of prisoners at Guantanamo. Saudi Arabia had about 134, 35 people, nationals. Yemen had about 109 or 10. At this point, only 20 Saudis remain at Guantanamo today. The rest have all been returned home. And yet, only 12 Yemenis have been returned home in the same period of time in over 6 years. At this point, of the 265 or so men who remain at Guantanamo, The largest group, the largest country group, are Yemenis, who make up a full one-third of the population there now, and a proportion that has steadily grown larger as prisoners from other countries are steadily released and returned home. So the availability of habeas now helps change the calculus of these decisions about release from a political one to more of a legal one, giving men like Mr. Taher, who should never have been at Guantanamo to begin with, but who haven't been able, whose home country hasn't been able to secure his release through a political channel, the chance to finally have a court and a real judge rule on his detention and decide whether his detention is warranted or not. And we think that the decision would ultimately be that it is not warranted and that he should be sent home. And as a former commander at Guantanamo once admitted to the press, quote, "Sometimes we just didn't get the right folks," and this goes to Bahar's point about who is at Guantanamo, and you have admissions from the government saying these, you know, saying that they got the wrong guys much of the time. But he said, "Innocents remain at the base because no one wants to be the one to sign the release papers. There's no muscle in the system." And now with Boumediene and habeas, we think that that decision restores the traditional role of the federal courts as that muscle, so that it's not entirely a political and a governmental decision about who remains at Guantanamo and who is sent home. For another of our clients, a court order for release alone won't mean freedom from Guantanamo. He is one of the 50 or so men who can't return to his home country because he fears being tortured or persecuted if he is returned there. And he remains essentially trapped at Guantanamo, even in the event of a court order for his release, until we can find a third country, a safe third country, willing to come forward and take him in and offer him protection. This prisoner's name is Jamel Amezien. He's an Algerian who left his country in the early 90s to escape the civil war there, and who doesn't want to return because he feels because he fears being targeted and detained and perhaps tortured in detention, in part because of a past history of discrimination that his family experienced in Algeria, and in part because of the stigma of being a Guantanamo prisoner and the collateral consequences that that carries. Like Mr. Taher, the government doesn't accuse Mr. Amezien of taking up arms against the United States or being a member of al-Qaeda, but has justified his detention solely on the basis of vague and unsupported accusations of a tenuous sort of association with al-Qaeda. He was one of the first group of prisoners to arrive at Guantanamo. He was transferred there in 2002, and he was held for the first 4 months of his detention in a small wire mesh cage that is now infamous as the holding pens of Camp X-Ray, which we all heard a lot about back in the earlier days of Guantanamo. For the past year, he has been held in conditions of virtual isolation and solitary confinement in one of the maximum security facilities at Guantanamo. This camp is called Camp 6, and even the International Red Cross has described Camp 6 as more severe than the most restrictive supermax facilities in the United States. And keep in mind that this individual has not been charged with any crime. His cell has no windows, it allows no natural air or light, and it is so small, and he's been held there for so long that he is now slowly losing his vision. He's going blind from sitting in his cell all day with the walls this close to his face. 70% of all prisoners at Guantanamo are held in either Camp 6 or one of two other maximum security facilities like that, where prisoners are kept in conditions of virtual isolation. And again, you know, no more than 20 people at Guantanamo have been charged with any crime, so the majority of the people held in these kinds of conditions have not been charged and could very well be released once their cases are presented before a court. Mr. Amezien, like Mr. Taher, is another case where we think a judge would order release once she hears the facts of his case, but again, he can't actually leave Guantanamo, even with that order, until we find a third country for him. And so for our work, that means that as actively as we will pursue his habeas case, we simultaneously, in parallel, need to lobby and do advocacy work with other countries. And we're doing that in Europe. My colleague, Emmy McLean, has been spearheading our coordination efforts on that front to find safe third countries of resettlement for individuals, either in Europe. For Mr. Amezien, we're pursuing work in Canada because he has family ties there, and resided there for a number of years before he was brought to Guantanamo. So that kind of both litigation as well as advocacy and lobbying are both critical pieces to the work we have to do to ultimately free him from Guantanamo. And the last prisoner that I want to mention is an individual that I actually met in Afghanistan who is being detained at a relatively new U.S. facility that he had been transferred to from Guantanamo and who had been held in at least two other U.S.-run facilities before that. And I want to mention his case for two reasons. And one is because it really puts Guantanamo in the context of this broader circuit or network of detention facilities and locations where now thousands of people have been held at one time or are currently being held in the custody of the United States or pursuant to its authority. And it shows the scope of the problem of illegal detentions by the United States. And it also raises the issue of how we might use decisions like Boumediene to extend them to reach detentions by the United States beyond Guantanamo. And I know you don't like that, Stephen. This prisoner's name is Aminullah Tuhi. He's an Afghan whom the U.S. accuses of being associated with the Taliban, and this is despite the fact that actually he fled Afghanistan in the mid-90s to neighboring Iran precisely to escape the Taliban regime. But this is the accusation the U.S. has against him and the basis for calling him an enemy combatant. He was working as a taxi driver in Iran in 2001 when he was arrested by the Iranian authorities for driving his taxi without proper documentation. And he was transferred by the Iranians to Afghanistan, who ultimately transferred him to the United States. And once in U.S. hands, he, again, on the basis of he was picked up because he was driving, he was working illegally without documents. On the basis of virtually no evidence and really flimsy accusations, he was sent to an underground prison outside of Kabul, where he was held for a year and 3 months. And by his description, we think that this, or his description matches a facility we know now is run, or an underground secret prison that was run by the CIA around that time, where prisoners were transited through on their way to other facilities. This prison was called the Prison of Darkness. It's taken different names, but that was one name that was given. From there, after a year and 3 months, and I spoke to him, and literally underground means underground. He didn't see light for 15 months. From there, he was sent to Bagram, where he was held for 1 month. Bagram is the main U.S. military base in Afghanistan, and currently there are over 600 people detained there. They don't have access to lawyers. We know very little about them, and actually the conditions there in terms of the black hole that they're being held in and the incommunicado conditions of their detention resembles quite what Guantanamo used to be in its earlier days, and that's the current situation at Bagram right now. He was held for a month in Bagram, and then from Bagram was sent to Guantanamo, where he was detained for over 5 years. In April of 2007, after a full circuit of prisons and 5 years at Guantanamo, a military tribunal actually determined that he was not being properly held and should be released from Guantanamo, but it took another 8 months for him actually to board a plane. Once he did board the plane and realized that he was leaving Guantanamo, he thought he would be going home to his wife and to his son, who, when I met him, told me that his son no longer recognizes him because it's been so long that he's been away. But he, in fact, was put on a plane leaving Guantanamo only to be transferred to continuing detention at this facility where he's now being held. The facility where he's being held is called the Afghan National Detention Facility, the ANDF, and it is a special unit that was built within a Soviet-era prison outside of Kabul called Policharki Prison. And this unit, the United States built in 2007 specifically for the purpose of holding prisoners transferred from Bagram and from Guantanamo. There are currently over 200 prisoners being held there. Some have been charged and put through unfair trials on the basis of evidence that the United States military has actually trained. Yet the United States calls this an Afghan-controlled facility. But again, the United States built it, it funded it, it trained and installed its jailers, and it continues to have an active mentoring and advising role in relationship to the prison. And significantly, it weighs in terms of decisions about who is transferred there, who is charged, and who can be released. So at a minimum, there are serious questions about the U.S.'s involvement in the prison. And we and other lawyers are now actively analyzing Boumediene and another Supreme Court decision that we haven't talked about yet, but that came down the same day as Boumediene, called Mounaf. The petitioners there called Mounaf. They were, this case involved two habeas petitions brought on behalf of U.S. citizens who were being held in Iraq. And the Supreme Court actually held that in terms of jurisdiction, federal courts could reach their habeas cases despite the fact that they were being held in Iraq, even further away than Guantanamo. So we're actively looking at that decision as well to see what the opportunities are, what the openings are to be able to challenge detentions in sites and in locations outside of Guantanamo, and not just in Afghanistan, but again, beyond. So those are the stories of some of our prisoners. Just as a last point, in terms of a very recent bit of news about where we are now, I just wanted to mention that today, the cases are it seems, moving forward. Today, there was a status conference in the D.C. District Court by the chief judge who's overseeing the cases, and we had two of my colleagues were there, Shane Kadidal and Gita Gutierrez. And Gita was actually the first civilian American lawyer to visit Guantanamo. And they presented on behalf of counsel for prisoners and responded quite effectively to the government, still despite several decisions from the Supreme Court and a very clear mandate from the Supreme Court that there can be no further delay for these cases and that prisoners have just been held for too long, is still pushing back and trying to find ways to delay the process, and is saying that it needs time to produce information and evidence and just finding various ways to again circumvent the decision. But it seemed from listening in on the phone that the judge was quite supportive and sympathetic to our position. And this week, the judge will probably issue an order scheduling the cases to move forward. So it was a good day for us in court. Thank you very much.
That was Pardis Cabral, staff attorney, Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.